Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we'll hear the conclusion of a three-part conversation between Rice University professor James M. Tuer, who was recently named one of the world's 50 most influential scientists, and philosopher of science Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture. This time, Dr. Tuer takes the interviewer role, armed with questions from listeners to his own podcast. Their talk covers a fascinating range from the Big Bang to the theology of exobiology to the intelligent design of viruses and bacteria and more.
So now I'm going to start reading off some questions from the audience, and there's several of them, so try to answer them fairly concisely, Steve. Says, Dr. Meyer, how would you combat somebody who believes in the multiverse, an infinite number of universes, so that life had to happen eventually?
Lots of physicists will now say, you know, you've got a choice in how to interpret the fine-tuning evidence. You can either say it's the result of some kind of supermind, a theistic design interpretation, or you can opt for the multiverse. It's kind of a wash. The multiverse is the idea that there are billions of other universes out there such that the incredible improbability associated with the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics and initial conditions of the universe that improbability gets massively diminished because there are so many universes that the right conditions had to arise somewhere. The problem with this explanation, there's multiple problems, but the biggest one is this, that you can't just posit other universes, because if all the other universes are separate from ours, having no causal interaction, then things that happen in those other universes don't affect anything that happens in our universe, including the probabilities of the fine-tuning. So proponents of the sort of naturalistic approach to explaining the fine-tuning realize that, and realize that to explain the origin of the fine-tuning, they needed a universe-generating mechanism, something that would allow them to portray our universe as the outcome of a kind of cosmic lottery in which the universe-generating mechanisms were spitting out lots of different universes, and would then ours just happen to be the lucky one. And that's where the rub comes in, because both of the speculative cosmologies that have been used to posit or to explain the multiverse or to generate multiple universes, inflationary cosmology and string theory, require universe generating mechanisms that themselves require prior unexplained fine-tuning. So in the inflationary universe, for example, the inflaton field has to shut off with just the right energies in just the right narrow window of time. And there's a very incredibly precise fine-tuning associated with that. So in order to explain fine-tuning, you posit a multiverse, but for the multiverse to actually explain fine-tuning, you need a universe-generating mechanism, but the universe-generating mechanisms require prior unexplained fine-tuning. So the multiverse doesn't really get rid of the fine-tuning, it just pushes it back one generation.
Good. I remember you and I were at a meeting one time together, and a Nobel laureate was pushed a little bit on giving an explanation for this, and he said, well, we're here, so it must have happened.
Yes, yeah.
And that was as good as he could get. And I remember you and I looked over at each other like, boy, we wish he had some more substance than that.
You get the same thing with the origin of life problem. Is since we're here, it must have evolved by chemical evolution, but we don't have a model and we don't have a plausible reaction, but since we're here, it must have happened. But what's assumed in that is that it must have happened materialistically, and there's obviously another alternative explanation. It may have been designed. Right. Same thing with the fine-tuning of the universe.
Right. So here's another question. It's this type of question that gets me angry, but you're a much calmer person than I am. A documentary I saw said it's possible to have the universe pop into existence on its own entirely spontaneously, entirely uncaused, and entirely in accordance with the laws of physics. What's your answer to that?
These questions are fun and great because I've just been writing on all of this. This is my new book, Return the God Hypothesis, is specifically addressing the counter-arguments to the fine-tuning argument, which is the multiverse, and the counter-arguments to the cosmological first cause argument, which is something called quantum cosmology, which is what this the documentary was referring to. And the idea there is that when the universe is very, very small, inside what's called Planck time, it would have been small enough to be describable by the mathematics associated with quantum physics. And there's a couple of very weird paradoxes that are strange things that come out of this. This has been invoked as a way of getting around the idea that of the Kalam first cause argument. Whatever begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe must have had a cause. Since causes are separate from themselves, the cause must be a transcendent cause, something beyond matter, space, time, and energy. That's been an increasingly popular argument marshaled by people like William Lane Craig, and based on the discovery that the universe did in fact have a beginning. This quantum cosmology stuff has been an attempt to circumvent that by saying, well, in the smallest smidgens of time just after the beginning, the universe could have been described using quantum physics. And they use something called a universal wave function that describes all the possible states of affairs the universe might have had, and then claim that if the universal wave function that comes out of these equations of quantum physics describes a universe like ours, it explains as one of the possibilities, then it explains the origin of our universe. Couple weird problems though. Before there's a universe, the quantum cosmologists depict reality as essentially purely mathematical. It's simply this universal wave function. And one of the most perceptive of these physicists, Alexander Vilenkin, has said, well, wait a minute. If before there's a physical universe, all there is this universal wave function describing mathematically all the possible universes that could exist, that's a purely mathematical reality. And math typically exists in minds. Are we then saying by our quantum cosmological modeling of the origin of the universe that the universe came out of a mind? He raises that as a rhetorical question in the last chapter of his book, Many Worlds in One, and never really answers it. Hawking, who also was a proponent of quantum cosmology, asked a similar question. He said, what puts fire in the equations that gives them a world to describe? Math by itself has no causal efficacy. It isn't something that causes things to happen. Math is something that exists in a mind that we use to describe things that happen in the world. So these types of explanations depend on the strange proposition that math produces matter. And that's very weird. And in fact, it seems to be almost Platonic and certainly a bit theistic, because math also in our experience only exists in a mind. And secondly, prior to all that, to get this universal wave function that's supposedly explaining the origin of the universe from math alone, there's a prior equation that has to be solved called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. It's the analog of the Schrodinger equation from quantum physics. And that equation can't be solved unless the physicist chooses specific constraints on the equation. It otherwise has an infinite number of solutions unless the physicist constrains mathematical degrees of freedom by imposing what are called boundary conditions and boundary constraints. And those are always chosen with an end in mind, to get a universe out the other end like ours. So it's very much like the origin of life simulation experiments, where the simulator, in this case the mathematical modeler, is constraining possibilities, inputting information to get an outcome that he wants. So I think, again, what's actually being simulated is the need for a creator or a mind to bring a universe like ours into existence. So even those quantum cosmological explanations that say you can get universe to pop into existence from the laws of physics alone presuppose some things that are really very theistic in their implications.
Okay, the next one. Is it possible God made other forms of life on other galaxies or universes with their own rules, i.e. Bible? If so, would that undermine the argument for intelligent design? Also, what about SETI program? Doesn't the method that we use to search for alien life argue for intelligent design?
Great question. Let me take the second one first. It's a bit more straightforward. The SETI method is in fact predicated on the assumption that information in the digital and specified form that we define carefully in among ID proponents is a definitive indicator of intelligence. So they're looking for things like the prime number sequence, okay, something like that. And if they find it, they're going to say, ah, that's an intelligent agent. That's information embedded in a radio signal. So the presupposition of SETI is that information, specified complexity, is an indicator of intelligent activity. They haven't found that yet in any radio signal or any other signal coming from outer space, but it's interesting that it presupposes the very method of design detection that's used by intelligent design proponents. And that, secondly, we found that kind of information at the foundation of life in DNA and RNA and proteins. As for life on another planet, I think, or in other, probably other galaxies, we know there is no life on the other planets in our solar system. We have now found some extrasolar planets, but as I understand it, they have highly eccentric orbits. All the ones that have been identified are not life-friendly in that they pass way too close and come way too far away from their host suns. The temperature variations are too great. But if life were found on another planet, I don't think that would undermine the case for intelligent design. Likely, if we studied that life, it would require prior foundational information as well, and that would be an indicator of intelligent design. We don't have any indication from science or from the Bible that there is life in other places, but it's not impossible from either perspective. So I'm open to that, and I don't think it's dispositive for the question of intelligent design one way or another.
Should we find it?
You're really,
we haven't yet.
you're really good at answering these. Dr. Meyer, what arguments do naturalists/materialists think are practical in understanding that the material world as we know it had a beginning/the Big Bang?
Well, that's another great question, and it's a wonderful story of how we discovered the beginning. Jim and I were at a conference a couple summers ago with a French astrophysicist, Jean-Pierre Lumine, who's written a book in French about the invention of the Big Bang and its fascinating story. The key evidence, I think, the first big evidence, was the discovery that the galaxies are moving away from us, and that was the evidence of that was provided by the red shift, the spectral signatures of the light coming from distant galaxies were shifted in the red end of the ultraviolet spectrum. And the red end is the longer wavelengths, so that suggested that the light was being stretched out. Light gets stretched out as objects move away. And so as the astronomers began to survey the night sky, they found in every quadrant of the night sky, there was the light coming from the distant galaxies was shifted in that red direction. Well, with a few anomalies here and there, but overwhelming testimony of an expanding universe. So that was the first big thing. The other really big indicator came out of theoretical physics with Einstein's theory of general relativity and the field equations of general relativity that were later solved by Hawking and Penrose and George Ellis. And this suggested that Einstein's theory was that matter curves space. And he knew that if gravitation was the only force in the universe, then we should have long ago collapsed in on, all the matter should have collapsed in on itself, and we should have a kind of giant black hole. But since we don't live in that kind of universe, we live in a universe with celestial bodies with great deal of space between them, there must be some counteracting force of expansion. And if there's an expanding force, then that implies most likely that we live in a dynamic universe that is expanding in size. And Einstein didn't like that implication at first. He tried to gerrymander the forces with something called the cosmological constant and give it exactly the right value so that the expanding force and the contracting force were just right. But that level of fine-tuning was implausible, and it didn't work. And then later they found the evidence of the expansion with the red shift. Then there were a whole series of other evidences that came online, the cosmic background radiation and others. So the evidence for the Big Bang is, I think, widely accepted by scientists of all philosophical persuasions. The question is, what do you make of it philosophically? I think the beginning implies a transcendent cause beyond matter, space, time, and energy. I think it does provide it. I think the discovery does have theistic implications.
Okay. Some people believe that scripture supports the theory that God created the earth, but then the earth was destroyed, i.e. Satan's fall, and then God recreated the earth. What's your opinion?
I've not heard too much about that. I would say that in proponents of intelligent design come in lots of different philosophical persuasions. Most are theists, but some are agnostics. I happen to be a Christian and a proponent of intelligent design, and I think a biblical understanding of design in nature or of nature is twofold. We should expect from a biblical point of view to see evidence of design, original design or aboriginal design, but from a biblical point of view, we should also expect to see evidence of decay. In fact, I think in Romans it says that the nature is in bondage to decay. The created order is in bondage to decay, and so I become very interested in the evidence we have of both of those things. And I think without getting into a very detailed what's called a theodicy of how evil entered the world, and theologians think about that a lot. I think generally we see exactly what we ought to expect from a biblical point of view. We see exquisite evidence of design, but we see evidence of that design being eroded or decayed or degradation. And we have a colleague at University of Idaho, Scott Minnick, who works on virulence, and he tells me that among microbiologists who look at virulent bacteria and viruses that are nasty to humans, that invariably what you have is either an information loss from an aboriginal system that wasn't harmful to us, or information being expressed out of its original and proper context. So I think that we're seeing at a microbiological level both evidence of design and evidence of subsequent decay. That's after all what a mutation is. So I think the biblical natural theology or theology of nature comports well with what we see in nature.
Okay. That dovetails right into this question. All the recent talk of viruses has caused me to wonder about the idea of God breathing life into Adam. While Adam would already need to be alive to be affected by viruses as we understand them, this causes me to ponder how God breathing life into Adam could have been a far more literal process than I've previously considered. To borrow a phrase from the Green Mile, could God have somehow infected us with life? And could viruses be a key to understanding how something like this might have happened?
Very interesting. This dovetails beautifully with the previous question. Scott Minnick has shown that, for example, the plague bacterium, and we're not talking about viruses yet, but the plague bacterium, which has been a very striking example of what theologians call natural evil, it is the result of four discernible mutations from an aboriginal bacterium for which our bodies had a natural immune response. It was a completely benign bacterium that was altered by this series of mutations. So that would be an example of that kind of decay or degradation of a beautifully and well-designed original system. Now, we have another colleague, Don Ewart, who's a virologist, who's working on this same issue. Viruses cause a lot of problems, so what happened? Were they originally designed, or were they... And he's working on a theory, and there's quite a lot of support for this in general, that viruses have had an original role of, effectively, they were part of an information processing system that maintained the proper balance of different bacterial organisms, for example, in the human gut or in the gut of other mammals, that we need a particular balance of different bacterial species, and that viruses were a way of transferring genetic information laterally to maintain this proper balance of different species of bacteria in the larger bacterial populations. So that's a new idea and a new take on this, but it's very interesting, and he's working on a very detailed paper on it and finding a lot that supports it. So it's a kind of an active area of interest for ID proponents. The bacterial question is making a lot of sense as far as evidence of design and decay, and there's an interesting avenue of research developing, or an interesting hypothesis that's being developed about viruses. So stay tuned on that. It shows how the ID concept is generating a lot of new research ideas.
That was the last part of three in a wide-ranging conversation between James M. Tour and Stephen C. Meyer. For the rest, just look up James M. Tour at idthefuture.com. And with fascinating, important conversations like these, we know you want to help get the word out. And so we ask you to just go to your podcast app of choice and leave a favorable rating there and a good review for ID the Future. That does help us get the message out to others. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.